Welcome to the Be Here Now Network guest podcast. This series features talks from a myriad of modern spiritual teachers expanding on how we can all live a life in balance. If you're interested in supporting this podcast, please go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/guest.
Greetings, everyone. I'm so happy to be here at Menla Mountain Retreat Center and Spa Resort with my dear friend and esteemed colleague, Nina Rao, who is a great musician and closely works with the great Krishna Das, and also a great environmentalist and has been working for decades to save the tiger and save the forest and save you and me, as all things interconnected. So I wanted to interview her for the podcast. I have no idea which podcast this is or what its title will be, but Nina and the Tigers, maybe. And also she wanted to interview me about that. So we're interviewing each other. Okay.
Yes.
So welcome, Nina.
Thank you.
So happy to have you.
I'm honored to be called a colleague because actually I'm not a colleague.
Of course you
I am
are.
Just
a
your student.
Are you kidding? I'm a student.
Disciple. Yes.
I'm a student.
Yeah.
Listen, powerful women all have to speak up and be save this world because men are berserk and they're wrecking it. You know? So the women have to really step up, you know.
But one of the things you said this morning, which kind of stood out for me while we were having our sessions, at the end of the session, was you said that Mother Nature was going to come along and win the election.
Yes.
So that's a huge statement to make about everything that's going on.
Yes.
But I'm particularly interested from the standpoint of nature,
yes,
with the capital N,
yes,
or even with the small n. Nature, right, as we know it, as all the trees outside,
yes,
all the birds, animals, trees that live within it. And my work has been in preserving wild tigers, particularly in India, because it is actually the last viable living wild population of tigers in the world.
Of course.
Which is such a strange thing considering the more than billion people that live in this country whose,
yes,
mouths have to be fed.
Yes.
But then you were talking about the majesty of India. And
yes,
to me, one of the majestical things of India is that despite everything or because of everything,
yes,
India has still been able to preserve 3% of their land mass.
Oh, good.
For wilderness areas.
Oh, good.
Which started in the early days with the princely states wanting,
yes,
to preserve the land so that they could kill them.
That's right.
They like to hunt.
Hunting preserve, right.
And then the British came along and that continued. But,
right,
the land remained because of that.
That's really good.
And then with the Wildlife Protection Act in 1972 or 73 in India, they were declared national forests.
Wonderful.
So nothing could be done.
Yes.
However, there were still indigenous people living in some of the areas,
yes,
who now want to come out and live a modern life and,
oh, really,
so forth, which is okay if they want to.
Do really? None of them want to stay in the...
Not really, because they're actually quite poor.
Yeah.
You know, they don't really have the means to live the way...
I see.
But there are
the very Elwin sort of...
yeah.
The tribes, wonderful tribal descriptions he had.
You know? Yes, I know. And that, you know, if they can maintain some of their traditions of their crafts and,
right,
prayers and songs and so forth, that's fine.
Right.
But they really can't live necessarily well,
right,
in the forest. So they might be relocated and given proper dwellings to live in and so forth.
Right.
So one of the things that I've been doing is working with scientists in India,
uh-huh,
who are documenting...
I see.
Just how the wildlife move,
oh, really,
in corridors,
oh, great,
how much prey there is in each of the,
uh-huh,
areas to sustain a tiger,
yes,
which is at the top of the food chain.
Yes.
And then everything that's required to sustain this population,
yes,
of wildlife, which essentially means our not disturbing it.
Yes.
And what do we disturb it for?
Not lessening it.
Not encroaching on it either. But the way India is, the humans butt up right against the wildlife preserves. Not only in India, but...
There's no chance to increase the size?
Very difficult. It's hard to even just keep it as it is because you have the villagers coming in to feed, bring their cattle into the forest and so forth. So it's an issue.
Yeah.
So one of the agencies that I work with, they actually help the farmers and who live around the forest to be compensated, for example, if their cattle are taken by tigers, which sometimes they'll come out when they feel pushed out. You know, there are all kinds of things that go on. So that's what these organizations are doing. And the scientists are following the movement of the animals, their health, and so on.
Wonderful.
And I feel it's very important to have science-driven conservation along with lobbying. So both, they both have to happen at the same time.
Do you know this guy Kadgil in Pune?
Yeah.
You know him?
I know his name, but I don't know him in person.
I read an article about him just now when I was in Goa.
Yes.
And I was really impressed with him.
Yes.
What a wonderful person with the Western Ghats. He's
exactly
which have a name that he likes better than Western Ghats. I can't remember what Vindhya or something.
Vindhyachal.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And he thinks of it as a female, and it's like he loves it, and he goes hiking in there all the time. He's an anthropologist, I think, Cambridge educated, and lives in Pune. I thought he might be one of the scientists.
Yeah.
If not, you should recruit him because he. Was complaining about the real estate interests in India.
Yes.
And he was trying to stop them, and he made big predictions about a year or two ago or so, and they all ignored it and said he was too extreme. And then they had these terrible floods, and all those people died in Kerala and so on.
Yes.
And we also had floods further north. And then now they're listening to him or something they were saying. And I don't know if they really are. But.
It's difficult because the business interests, like here, same thing.
Yes.
You know, they have a lot of power. And in a struggling country, as we know, India is, it's hard to put above the needs of human beings and what they need to consume that we want to put aside this land, which we've done in this country. It's a miracle, the amount of natural forest and natural national parks that we have.
Yes, thanks to Teddy Roosevelt. See, those are real Republicans who made those.
Yeah.
You see, these so-called Trump Republicans, and even Reagan Republicans, they're not real Republicans. Mm-hmm. They're fake Republicans because they have some demented notion of the, you know, connected with a distorted interpretation of Christianity where they think God is making a new world later and they can use up the old one and destroying. So they're actually radical and they're destructive and they don't conserve like really good wealthy people have done in the past.
Yes.
So that's why we're not against wealthy people in trying to rebalance things.
Yes.
We're for the ones who are really serious about having a long-term committed to a long-term preservation of the wealth because
it is real.
It's not opposite human need. Human need is, you know, we have children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, they're going to need this.
They're the stewards of
We have the stewards for them, and we're wrecking it, and that's no good.
Yeah. So one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because you're very interested in this topic, is global climate.
Yes.
And I've understood that you've done Al Gore's course.
I did. In August, I gave up my 78th birthday to go to Al Gore, August 2 to 4, and receive his training.
Yes.
Climate Reality Project Leadership Training. I had no idea it was called. I never had heard. I knew about Al Gore, and I deeply admired him, Inconvenient Truth.
Yes.
But I didn't know his organization is called Climate Reality Project, which I love.
Yes.
Because my whole thing about Buddhism, which of course I'm into, is that Buddhism is realism, actually. Mm-hmm. It's really what it is. It's not really some religion where by believing something you're going to be saved. It's by becoming more and more aware to what reality is and discovering it's actually good if you take care of it.
Yeah.
And it will take care of you because it's benevolent to you. And that's what it is. It's Buddha means to wake up to reality, basically. In other words, not wake up to some thing off world, you know, like go to heaven with God and sing in the choir.
Right.
That's not what it is.
Yeah.
It's beware that this reality is beautiful, exquisite, human adaptable thing, and other animals as well. We are responsible for them, and we should have to take care of it.
I agree. And one of the things I read a while ago was that the original structures of cathedrals, actually come from the shape of the trees in the forest.
Yes, oh, really?
That's where it came from. So I always find it interesting that we have been disconnecting from nature so much over time. And I think then that's why it's not considered wealth anymore.
That's right.
And to preserve it.
Right.
But for some of us who see the beauty in it and also how it's carried in all the art and tradition and culture, you know, every description of divine beings is accompanied by you know, natural flowers, trees.
Yes.
And I read the Ramayana. They talk about how the rishis were practicing in the forest so much that the very leaves of the trees would echo the sound of the mantras they're chanting.
Of course. Trees are breathing back to us.
Yeah.
The oxygen that we need, and then they're taking our carbon and they're making green and beautiful things.
Exactly.
And it's a great symbiosis we have and a loving relationship with the plants, and they love us. In the medicine Buddha's world, everything that grows and everything that lives and breathes is all interconnected in a positive way.
Right.
If governed by wisdom and knowledge, if distorted by ignorance and greed and aggression, then it doesn't work. Of course, that's when we can bring that. Our ignorance can bring that.
So it's an imbalance.
Yes, and we've now reached this mega point where, in a way, modern culture thinks industrialization is an unalloyed good, and it really makes us separate, and it's called civilization and blah, blah, blah. And that's completely wrong, actually, because what happened in the West, and to some extent also everywhere, and then since then, everywhere in the world, is that what in ancient India were called the outer sciences, how to manipulate the materials of the world, raced ahead of the inner sciences, and the inner world was thought to be just as a province of some kind of religion or something. Mm-hmm. And then even the materialist ideology came and crushed the inner world by saying there is no such thing. Mm-hmm. It's just the outer world not understood properly, but in your brain, it's just your brain. It's not your mind, not your soul, and not your spirit. And so the industrialization has basically been the industrialization of ignorance, the industrialization of hatred, that's called modern industrial militarism, and the industrialization of greed, and that's called consumerism and using of everything, using it all up. And now we see that that's destroying the world, actually. Right. And so it's not like people go, it's like the thing we had in the lumber industry in the West. The people who were lumbermen, they just wanted to cut it all down.
Yeah.
And then when you said no, we don't have jobs now. We don't have livelihood, and this is ruinous. But actually, the conservationists were keeping the wood there growing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it would go on in future generations. If they cut it all down, they still don't have jobs.
Right.
And I tried to get one environmentalist group that sues the companies to prevent them from cutting trees and are hated by the lumber industry. I tried to say, why couldn't they get together with the lumber industry, go to the high schools where the lumber people's children go to school, and hire some Viennese and Italian fantastic furniture makers, and have them have shops in the high schools of making beautiful, expensive, like Japanese, like European marvelous furniture, to really add value, because the trees that are cut are shipped off to China and Japan, and they doesn't really help. It's just very short term. It's very low price. It doesn't add value, and they wouldn't. They said, that's not our job. We can't do that. They wouldn't even consider that. Even the environmentalists.
I mean, there's two ways of looking about. We do need wood.
Yeah, sure.
We need wood, so we can always have plantations.
Yes,
but what I'm most interested in is actually the preservation of the ancient indigenous forests.
Yes.
Because the wisdom that lives in those forests, we can never recreate.
Well, of course.
We can never recreate. Yes. And I feel that somehow that's lost on...
Somehow. Directly. Look at Bolsonaro in Brazil.
Yeah.
Today, they're already fed up with him in Brazil. Percentages are going way down. Yeah. But he rode in a white horse and cavalry, into the capital, Brasilia, and he's showing that he's going to crack down and be a fascist dictator. He hopes. So they have that now. We have someone who wants to be a dictator, and he's aided and abetted by the wrong industries, here in America.
Yeah.
So there's a major thing has to go on the planet,
Yeah.
A major thing. So do you connect with like Vandana Shiva and these kind of folks in India and Arunati Roy and people like
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
Are you buddies with them?
Yeah, they're all a community and everybody's working a different angle.
Oh, good.
My angle happens to be specifically preservation of the forest, because if we don't even start there by keeping what we have, then what are the chances that we're going to be able to take strides in any other direction?
Yes,
because
absolutely.
From there goes, then we can talk about plantations. Yeah. Then we can talk
so
about...
So what do you need to be able to succeed in that mission? What do you lack and what do you need?
Well, firstly, of course, we're always trying to raise funds to sustain the right. conservationists who are in the field. But mostly also...
So, for example, you need, if you had $1 billion, what would you do with it? If someone said, here's $1 billion to preserve the Indian forest, what would you do?
$1 billion is a lot of money.
Yeah, but
I would have to, I mean, I would say, of course, that whatever means were required to sustain the people who live around the forests, who often don't have a lot of money or don't have means, they're the ones who get attracted
okay,
by...
Okay, so one thing you would do is you would build up the livelihood...
Of the humans who live...
So they would have, and also create a... ongoing income-producing livelihood
Correct.
For them,
for them who
where
live
they
there.
Wouldn't have to go and predate in the forest yeah. to maintain their livelihood.
Even not for their own
selves?
So that
selves? Would be, you know, 20 million, 50 million, whatever many it would be. That would
right.
be one prong of your
right.
your wonderful, triumphant, you know, I like Durga, but she has many arms and many weapons.
And she's on the tiger.
Oh, yeah. And she rides the tiger. yes,
right.
very good.
That's
so
right.
Durga.
Yeah, that's her.
So Durga Nina, that's you. Okay, so that one of your prongs is keeping the livelihood of the humans in close proximity to all of the major forests.
Yes.
Which you say is 3% of the land surface of the
in
of
India.
The, of Mother India.
Yeah.
That's one of the prongs. Okay, what is the second prong? And you're
educating people.
educating.
So that
okay.
the minds change. Because if that doesn't change,
yes.
then you're just hitting your head against the wall.
Right.
People have to understand the wealth that
yes.
we have. Because
yes.
once it's lost, there's
yes.
no way to get it
so,
back.
So, okay, prong number two, you need documentarians, you need artists.
That's what our scientists
you need,
do.
You need to buy time on television networks.
Yes.
You need to make films and documentaries and movies. So you'd have a division, you could, you know, you'd have like a Netflix for the forests.
Sure.
Or something in India, at
yes.
least. At
yes.
least, if not international.
I mean, it exists in different ways, but
you
yes.
You know, see, one of my crazy things that I like to do is people in our kind of role, one of the ways in which we are defeated by this industrial monster is that we're kind of made to feel that it's low priority. It's against jobs. It's against progress.
Right.
It's sort of backward. So we sort of think, and even the idea when you first heard said $1 billion, oh, that's a lot of money. It's like, oh,
well, no,
we
you know
never
why.
Expect it.
Because it
but
gets misspent in India. That's why I said
no, but
that.
The, yeah, but
yeah.
the point is
yeah.
that it's a priority, actually.
Yeah.
So, for example, to defend, like, people are dying by the hundreds of thousands of bad air
mm-hmm.
in these over-industrialized,
exactly.
coal dust-ridden cities and so forth. And that's costing huge things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in fact, $1 billion spent explaining to people how there can be other ways of living, how the forest is absorbing carbon, how we have to even expand and grow more and all this kind of thing. That is, in fact, saving money. And there are jobs
yeah.
doing that. And so money should be shifted. Heavy resources should be shifted like that.
But also...
So now you have two weapons.
And the other thing I think also that's important is, and I don't know how it would work, somehow in helping people understand that we need to use alternate fuel sources.
Yes.
That's a big part.
Renewable fuels. Yes.
Renewable fuels and keeping the waters clean because the
yes.
waters that flow from up and down into the forest
yes.
are often killing off a lot of the smaller species that live
yes.
and are a support to the environment.
Yes.
And without
oh,
frogs.
Oh, the frogs are being killed
yeah,
madly by pollution.
And
so
pesticides on crops are killing
oh,
all
Monsanto.
The insects. Yeah.
They ran away to Switzerland and Germany now.
Yeah.
Monsanto, because they were being sued here rather heavily, and they are really monstrous.
Yeah.
The amount of tons of that crappy stuff they throw on the field.
Yeah.
That's Vandana Shiva is trying to stop
yes,
that in the
is.
Agriculture. Very,
yeah.
And
no,
she's
she
working
is.
Very well,
she
I'm
is.
Sure lots of other people.
She is.
Okay, so to your two weapons so far, are with you when Durga's properly worshipped with $1 billion, are making the livelihood of the actual neighbors of the forest doable without further destruction of the forest, and second, informing the general public every way you can think of, artistic, drama, even, you know, making new what was it, Satyajit Ray, he made those beautiful movies.
Yeah.
But... So some movies about the villagers and the tigers and stuff, some more nature films to show them the value of that. And although then they say, oh, I don't want to be eaten by a tiger, and they get freaked.
So you you have to go into the schools, which is what a lot of the scientists who I work with and his organization...
Textbooks
and just going and talking to them. They want to see, they want to feel. Take them into the forest.
Hundreds of jobs for young students to learn to evangelize the nature and to do so in the Indian school system.
And there's even now universities.
How many high schools are there in India totally?
I have no idea.
Well, that's the thing. We have to know. There, I know there's a figure of 600,000 villages.
That sounds okay.
Does each one have, there's a figure that may not be up to date, but... Yeah. If there are 600, then there's at least 600,000 high schools.
Maybe. Not necessarily high schools, though.
Well, I see.
You know what I mean? Like it goes up to maybe elementary school in some places.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Well, you know, see, there, a lot of it has to do, the industrialization went along, of course, with the colonial conquest.
Mm-hmm.
And the colonial mentality, even in Indian elites today, is still acting like they don't live in India.
Yeah.
And they're using up the resources of India the way they did.
Yeah.
And then, for example, I know from a project I'm involved with by some Norwegians in cooperation with Tatas and other people in Mumbai, something called India 2022, that it is now, and it's also sponsored by Royal Dutch Shell and Baker, something, a branch of General Electric that makes windmills and things, that a gigawatt of electricity produced by renewables is half the price of a gigawatt of electricity produced by coal, and I think a third the price of electricity produced by oil or gas, because, it, of course, it has to be imported in India. There's no gas and oil that's been found in India, right? So... And yet, the coal lobby in the Indian government, as connected to the Indian government, is very powerful.
Sure.
There are also millions of coal miners. So again, you have to have another 100 million to retrain coal miners who I'm sure once they had new ways of doing things, they would be happy not to crawl down there in that dusty, getting black lung disease and so forth under the earth.
Yeah.
They'd be very happy. And then the bureaucrats who make money running the coal machinery and industry and transport and everything, we have to figure out some other thing for them to do to mainly manufacture windmills
and
solar panels.
Sure.
And India should catch up with China making solar panels. This other Norwegian group is working with a lot of marvelous young entrepreneurs in Bengaluru, especially very strong, to do all kinds of innovative and new things in this line.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no big money informing the Indian public of that this is a huge priority. In fact, does climate ever feature in any of Modi's speeches? Does BJP even mention it? It could be sold to them as patriotic, because for their big Hindutva thing that, you know, the Hindus take care of the nature, you know, for example, we could, if we had the money for a media program.
He's also busy trying to be prime minister. He's busy trying to be prime minister and feed people and give them jobs.
Yes, yes.
So that's primary on top of his agenda, you know. So
I know, but you see, it, like, for example, Jay Inslee here in America and Al Gore and this kind of person, they there's a big team in the economy department in Stanford, and they show that there's six times at the moment more jobs produced in renewable energy.
I'm in agreement
than in,
with you.
Than in any of these fracking and any horrible stuff that they do.
I'm in agreement with you, but I'm just thinking back to the time of the Paris climate summit.
Yes.
And when everybody was asked to sign this accord.
Yes.
And Al Gore actually was very instrumental in talking to the Ministry of Environment from India.
Oh, good.
Because they were reticent.
Yeah.
They said, you know, you've got to allow our country to develop. You all have gone ahead and developed and used all the resources and created all the bad air, and we're having to pay for it now.
Yes.
You have to allow us to at least develop to a certain degree.
Yes. Well, then that's true. And when we get in a proper Mother Earth government in America, which we're going to do this coming year, then one of the things, for example, the military, if not interfered with by a bunch of Neanderthals in the Senate, James Inhofe being one of the leaders of that, someone called Inhofe, who's from Oklahoma, and he's the employee of the Koch brother industries and big tar sands. And he has prohibited the military for requisitioning any part of their budget on the grounds of they're doing something for climate danger. For example, they just rebuilt docking facilities in Virginia Beach for their big ships, you know, to repair them and paint them and do stuff. And they built them 10 meters higher. But they couldn't say expecting sea level rise. They were not allowed to say that.
Sure.
They had to say it was because blah, blah, something, fake, make up something, because the senators are blocking that in the Appropriation Committee for the military. So the point is, we won't have that kind of a thing. And then if you look at the swollen military budget of the U.S., and since some really decent generals and admirals know that the climate change is a bigger enemy of every nation on Earth than any other country. The biggest enemy is the blob of carbon floating around the planet that's going to wreck all the ecosystems of all the countries. That's their enemy.
Yeah.
It's a common enemy. You know, you often hear that we'd have to have an invasion from outer space for all the United Nations to really unite, right? And not the Russians versus this, the Chinese versus that. Right. But we actually have.
So this is it.
We actually created it.
This is it. Absolutely. Is it.
So take $100 billion out of an $800 billion military budget and pay the coal industry, give the coal industry in India $3 billion of reparation to shift over to renewable, all the jobs, all the mines and everything, and to get more jobs than before and make Mr. Modi happy if he happens to still be the prime minister, which it looks like he will be for quite a while. So never mind, but Congress people, they don't think he's too whatever, but the point is he's going to be there. And so pay them as a reparation for precisely exploiting their resources and being colonialist and wrecking the planet. That's what they are talking about.
That is, I know.
And they need that, and they should have hundreds of billions. And to do that and to shift over. And, for example, in my Durga of America, one of her, I have a program called Bright Money. As the opposite of the dark money of the petroleum industry. And the Bright Money program is getting some billions from people who have pledged to give it all to Gates. And when they die, because by the time they die, those powerful women who often have it and are not using it to make more business leverage and things, they have no use for this, like 30, 40, 20 billion, you know. So, and they pledged half of it when they die to the Gates. But by that time, their children will be climate refugees at this rate. So take a few of those billions and start creating a mass media campaign worldwide about how this is their common enemy. This is what must be done. Any old forest must be saved. So two of your weapons. But is there any other weapons in your other arms, Durga Ji? What other ones do you have? Durga, by the way, to you Western people, is the mother goddess in a very fierce form. With how many arms does she have, actually, Durga?
I've seen her with six.
Six arms.
Yeah.
So she has weapons in these six arms, and she beats up all kinds of Me Too era male chauvinist weird demons. She beats them all up when the other good male gods can't handle them. You know, she does. It's
she
wonderful,
does.
Wonderful Indian thing. You know?
Yeah.
It's the Shekinah on a rampage with six weapons and six arms. Okay? So you should know that's Durga, it's called. And Durga means difficult to oppose.
Right.
Durga, Durgamana, to hard to go up against. I like it. So, okay, so what else? So these are the two things. I think the media thing is really important. That's my Bright Money thing. I want Al Gore to have a huge media platform.
Well, this is all
to do the Climate Reality Project internationally. I'm talking in Hindi.
Sure.
Like in Hindi, if you did a huge environment thing and people realize what's going on, you know, with that, their air and their water, they are going to demand that whatever government it is, that they do that. And I'm not into, like, Congress versus BJP, whatever. Whichever one is going to be for Mother Earth, and that's the one. Do you know, do you remember Buddha? When the statue of Buddha, he's meditating. He has one hand on a meditation like this. But one hand is over his right knee touching Mother Earth.
Sure.
And actually, he's calling on Mother Earth to testify that it's worthwhile to be a Buddha and to help beings. And that there's, and she has been witnessing his effort and she's providing his curriculum vitae, meaning multiple lives, that he's been helping people. And therefore, he has a right to help them as a Buddha, as a teacher. But so Mother Earth is critical.
Yeah.
critical, and she's in very much jeopardy. She's speaking through Greta Thunberg to everyone in the world, actually, and other people.
And lots of other people, but yeah, Greta's the big voice now because she's the voice of the young people.
She's the young. She's the future.
Yeah. You called her an oracle.
What?
You called her an oracle.
To me, she's a total oracle. Yeah. Because if you know the history of shamanism, mm-hmm. you know that where they get their oracles and their medicine man or medicine woman is a special sensitive type of person who, when they're a teenager or younger than that, just a puberty, usually around, so she's very early. She was eight or nine. Yeah. But, you know, they kind of fall apart because they see something going wrong in this way the tribe is living. They're not really connecting to the forces of nature and so forth, and they're not really being sustainable. And so then they fall apart kind of, and they have like a crisis. And then the elder medicine woman or man realizes this and gets them, helps them, and they go on a vision quest, and they do this and that. And then eventually they come together and they become the medium for the forces of nature. Sure. And in shamans, it can be connected with the tiger, mm-hmm. connected with the bear, connected sure. with the owl, connected with the serpent, connected yeah. with whatever it is. Yeah. And then they become the respected healer of the community. You know?
Yeah.
So that's her. She's this small, even a little bit fragile, a little bit damaged body produces this like deep voice of the earth itself. Mm-hmm. And people can't resist it in a way, although even though they try to, she's this autistic, I don't have to listen, she doesn't know about the jobs and the economy, she's unrealistic. They can say, but the message actually goes right
very
in.
Very clear. No, I went right to when she came to New York City.
Oh, yeah?
And she was talking down in Battery
Park. You saw her
Park.
Personally? Yeah, I tried to find, but I didn't.
Yeah, I went there just to see.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, I mean, many of my daughter left school, like all the kids left so that they could go and see her.
Good.
But most of the people there were the parents of those children.
Yes, really.
Because they're also taking ownership.
Course.
Like we have to, I hear people saying all the time, the younger generation is going to take care of everything.
No.
But we have to do it for them before.
Of course we do. They don't vote yet even. You know,
and how much damage are we going to leave for them to fix? There's not going to be anything left.
We're really at the absolute point now. You know, if we had started when the oil companies knew about it before the dark money weighed in and created doubt in the public's mind, with a huge expense of many billions were spent to deceive people. And actually, I mean, this is a little off the topic, but those corrupt senators are giving the petroleum industry just in America. $20 billion a year of subsidy because they're running out of oil, the poor things. Mm. It's like depletion allowance.
Sure.
And $20 billion. So if you then think that their media campaign, their lobbying organization in Washington, and their campaign contributions to corrupt, bribery-afflicted congresspersons and senators, if that cost them $2 or $3 billion, they're already making $17
billion. Yeah.
And we're paying for it to deceive us.
Right.
Actually, it's so distorted, you know, the whole thing.
Is.
And if those $20 billion right away should be shifted into developing renewable, and helping coal miners and oil people to get new employment and new skills and new jobs.
Well, this is
and
the green.
That immediately should happen.
This is Green New Deal, yes.
What?
The Green New
Deal.
Yeah,
this is Green New Deal, and it's already, you know, the Green New Deal that we heard about from Alexandra.
Yeah.
Alexandria, who's my dear buddy, Cortez. I mean, I personally met her only once, but I love her. And she's great.
Yeah.
But she just did it as a principal.
Sure.
But the Jay Inslee, who tried to run for president and then now is going back to run for a third term as governor in Washington State.
Yeah, he was wonderful.
Because he doesn't have the name recognition to compete in the national thing. But his detailed 130-page Green New Deal online, you can read it right now, jayinslee.com.
I did.
And it uses all the old New Deal agencies in the Interior Department, everything. It's really thought out.
Mm-hmm.
And it works really quickly.
Yeah, when I first saw him in the debate, I thought, this guy.
Absolutely.
But he didn't have the pizzazz
no,
or whatever.
Well, but and the name recognition.
And the name,
He has
exactly.
He has the degree, but he doesn't. But actually now we have the billionaire Tom Steyer, who already spent money on the environment.
Yeah.
And he's a bright money type of person. And he says that's going to be his first thing and his thing. But I don't think he can make president alone. But I think if he supports the dream team, all of them, then he could be energy secretary or EPA or something, and he could implement that. I think if we need a Mother Earth administration, that's what we need. Right. And they can have Republicans join them. There's William Weld. There's a very few non-Trump Republicans, and I think more would come out of the woodwork if they weren't terrorized by McConnell and Trump and rich dark money people. Yeah. Then there would be some Republicans who would join that. That's all right. You know, it would become bipartisan. Everything will become better, no question. Yeah. The so-called polarization is not going to be fatal. If we didn't make this effort, and if we had four more years of this Earth destruction going on, then we'd be in bad shape. They say that we have to, in the next 10 years, we have to planetarily diminish carbon level by 7% a year for 10 years.
Yeah.
And then we can be back into a more reasonable plane by the 2030. But we are increasing 2, 3, 4% every year instead of that. So we have to go 10% less.
Backwards. Yeah, exactly.
For 10 years.
Yeah.
And we have to start this year.
Now. So,
yeah, now. But, well, unfortunately not till 2021, because that guy will keep going, you know, unless they impeach all of them. And Nancy Pelosi becomes president, which would be great. But I don't think because of the Senate we can do that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, actually, to do it now, Pence being also guilty of the Ukraine thing, they impeach both of them, and then she, the Speaker of the House, is automatically the president. Mm. And she would then work with the Green New Deal, and we could do it immediately. But I don't think that can happen because of the Senate. You know?
Right, exactly.
So we won't be able to start really strongly, although maybe if we show our determination as a people, and if these movements make enough noise and show that they're serious, you never know. Maybe there could be some people start defecting from the dark money movement that has been wrecking everything since 1980, especially. Mm-hmm. But even the late 70s, they knew completely, the oil company scientists, this was happening in the late 1970s, totally. And then they, instead of going with it and making smaller changes then to shift over, they blocked
renewable.
The whole thing and they intensified the carbon production. Half of the carbon production since the 1800s has happened in the last 20, 30 years.
This to me is so interesting because it means then that the intensity with which we've been separated from nature or our connectedness with it has just kind of fallen into a dark hole, has been the strongest in just in the last few decades or a century or something.
Since the dark money people stole presidency from Gore.
Yeah.
Gore was supposed to be an Earth, Mother Earth administration in 20 years ago. And they stole it from him. And he did win. And then they stole it from him. Yeah. And then they did a big oil invasion and an unspeakable amount of oil, carbon pumped by all the wars and blowing up oil rigs by Saddam Hussein.
Sure.
People, unbelievable stuff. Yeah. And so it's just been really terrible. Anyway, never mind, let's not dwell on it. We're going to fix it. And back to the tiger. I think really also we should not settle for we can only preserve what we have. It shouldn't be increased.
It should. But if we don't even start there.
Yes. Now, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to ask you one other thing. Now I'm going to interview you again. What about how much do Indians really appreciate what's happening in the Himalayas, in Tibet, in relation to their water table? You know, I was invited by the first TED event in India, in Mysore, at Infosys campus. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a beautiful talk in 15 years, maybe. I don't forget what it was, maybe 15 years ago. Really, it was excellent. And about the water sources of India, especially North India, being the Himalaya and the glacier melt and what was going on there. But then I never got to give the talk because the people who organized it suddenly thought the Chinese would be really upset. Because that same one, I invited the young Karmapa and he went and gave a talk there. I was supposed to translate for him, but he didn't need me. He had another translator. And then I was going to give my talk. So two Tibet things. They thought that would really freak out the Chinese. I don't know why. I don't know if that was in India.
Yeah.
But so I didn't get to do it. But I really want to do that in the future. Because Indus, Ganga, Yamuna, Brahmaputra.
They all start from
there. They all come from glacial melt in between monsoons. And if the glaciers are finished in 10 to 20 years. And if that's when it will happen. It will not be 100 years. Mm-hmm. It'll be 10 to 20.
Yeah.
Then you have drought conditions throughout the residency of hundreds of millions of people. It's beyond apocalyptic.
It is, but I think that it's too hard for the common person to think about that.
Why?
It is. No. Because I'm not talking about us who have enough money to feed ourselves. I'm just saying in the last, let's say, 25 years, there's been a huge expansion in the Indian economy. It's opened up to the foreign markets. People now have houses. They can borrow money. They can get gas. They can find fuel. They can get everything that they want that they never could for so many years.
Yes.
So they're enjoying the fruits of that.
I'm not taking that away.
No, I'm not saying that you're not. I'm just saying it's not easy to talk about something that's so distant.
It isn't distant.
Right.
Did you know the floods they had in Patna?
Yeah.
And thousands of people killed when the Ganga freaked out up in Rishikesh, for example. What was that, 10 years ago, 8 years ago? I mean, and then there are these glacial breakouts as the glaciers melt too fast and so forth, and they will sweep away. And then, you know, they're building big hydroelectric, for example, in Bhutan. And then they'll have no water, then what?
Well, if it's hard.
And that's not far distant.
It's not. But if we can't convince people in the richest country in the world about these issues.
We're going to.
We will. But it's going to take time, is all I'm saying. So
no,
in India,
I
it's taking.
No time.
Right, right.
You know what? It's like, you know, there's so-called tipping points.
Yeah.
And tipping point, suddenly something that was impossible just happens.
Yeah.
And that does happen like that.
Yeah.
And bad things also happen like that.
But maybe good things too.
And actually, you know, Greta Thunberg did a great job and is doing a great job. But, you know, according to some people that I've met since I've been getting into the Al Gore circle thing, the one who's doing the biggest job is Mother Earth.
Yeah.
This and that hurricane, these fires,
she's showing,
floods,
giving us the signs.
Yeah, she's like dancing madly. Yeah. And that wakes people up. And you have your house, and you have your TV, and you have your iPhone, and this and that, and running, and then suddenly there's
it's
no
gone.
Water.
Yeah.
And then they have to bring a truck from somewhere far away.
Yeah.
Chennai had no water. Its whole lake north of Chennai was completely gone. The water finished. Yeah. They had to truck it in from somewhere else. In a big city.
Yeah. Well, in big cities, we have the same problem here too, Bob.
Yeah, but nobody's actually run out.
Not run out, but they don't even have clean water to drink in some places.
Well, they have poison water.
Yeah, right.
Which then the politicians try to hide from them.
Correct.
But I'm just saying, that's your answer to my question. You said that they can't really face it.
They can. It's just hard to change people's minds in that direction when for the first time they're enjoying certain benefits that they've never had.
Well, no, but I would question that. I would ask you to think about Durga.
Yeah.
I would ask you to think about it in the sense that it is precisely when people, you know, for example, Buddha was in India. Mm-hmm. The great siddhas were all in India. Mm-hmm. Patanjali was in India. Panini was in India. Mm-hmm. All these great knowledges happened in India when they were having dark ages in the West. And people think of India as poor. But in fact, so they imagine, oh, they did all these things and they meditated and they did yoga and they invented all that stuff because they were so poor. They did that because they were rich.
I agree.
And once you get rich and you realize that being rich does not make you happy, then you want to turn to yogas and to finding out about how your mind works.
That's why
India was so advanced
at that time.
They were way richer than China, way richer than Persia, way richer than Europe. It was totally backward.
Right. But you can't disagree that 40 years ago, little less than half the population was living below the poverty line.
Oh, yes.
Right.
In India. No.
So, right. So that's all I'm saying. So
yes,
in this recent past,
But that makes them able to be more educated and more international and able to understand things. And all those greatly educated Indian people, they're like running all the Silicon Valley. They're running all the big companies.
Right. So I want to just, what I want to just say, and for me, this is the only thing that's worked. And this is when I go out in nature.
Yes.
I understand the beauty of it.
Yes.
And I see it as a reflection of us. And it is and we are a reflection of nature as
Absolutely.
Well. And the only way to really know that, we can do mass media campaigns, we can do whatever, is to be in it.
Yeah.
And sit in nature.
Yes.
And somebody once mentioned to me a term, it's called drala.
What?
Drala.
Drala?
Yeah, drala. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche brought it up, and it's called...
Which Rinpoche?
Chogyam. Oh. Chogyam Trungpa. And he said, drala is the elemental presence of the world that is available to us through our sense perceptions.
Okay.
When we are open to nature,
uh-huh.
we encounter actual wisdom, which is not separate from us.
Oh, that's great. That's and nice.
So, you know, as much as we try to talk to people
yes.
and educate them,
yes.
the easiest way for someone to actually understand the value of nature is yes. to be in it. So yes. this is one of the things I love about the national park system in
yes.
in America,
yes.
is that it's available for everybody.
Yes.
And you can go in there and you can walk yes. around and feel what
sure.
that means to you.
That's what we're doing here at Menlo.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Exactly. And only if we preserve those areas are they there
I
for
totally
us
agree.
To actually even experience.
Yes. Menlo is in the middle of national forest.
Yeah.
And there's no neighbors. And did I ever tell you the story about the violinist lady?
Mm-mm.
There was one Korean-American lady, very tall, very beautiful, mm-hmm. who came here once when Sharon Salzberg and I were teaching. Mm-hmm. And she came to try to meditate because she developed some weird neural thing mm-hmm. where sounds were tormenting her. And she was second violin or in the New York Philharmonic. She was a great violinist, but she had to take a leave from her work. And her art and her craft, you know, profession, her vocation, and she couldn't play her violin or anything because sound would just drive her brain crazy. She would feel like she was being tortured. And then some brilliant neurologist sent her to Maryland somewhere and had her put her in an some kind of like fMRI machine that they use people who are shell-shocked.
Uh-huh.
And it made it 100 times worse.
Yeah.
So she was really a wreck when she got here. And okay. she was so much a wreck that she couldn't even listen to me and Sharon lecturing quietly and then also leading meditations. And we weren't talking really loud. You know, I'm a little loud. Sharon's a quiet voice. Well, no, she's a Leo too. She also has a voice. But anyway, she couldn't even hear that. She would leave the class. So then I was very worried. We were very worried about her. So I made an appointment to meet her and we were going to talk to her. And the next day or something, she was not coming to the classes. So then the next day she comes, and I'm so worried. And she said, oh, don't worry, I'm great. I'm feeling so much better. I said, really? I said, you didn't come to any class. She said, yeah, I know. But she said, I just had a feeling, and I went down to the stream here. And when I got near the stream, I sort of laid down because I was feeling very worried and freaked out because I couldn't even learn to meditate. And then I could just hear a very faint gurgling of the water. Because the water is very low. It was like August or July. We don't have much water. The spring doesn't produce a lot of water at that time. And there was somehow, then that sound became pleasant. Very slight sound of trickling water. It's not a big rushing stream, but that season. And then suddenly I heard the sort of wind a little bit rustling in leaves. And so for the last 24 hours, except at nighttime, I've been listening down by the stream to the different sounds in nature.
Sure.
And I can see the path back to being able to hear. And so I'm fine. Please don't worry about me.
That's beautiful.
And then she was able to come to a class yeah. or two. She added some mindfulness practice.
Yeah.
But the nature itself got to her when we, with meditation instruction, couldn't reach her.
Yeah.
And that was the Menla itself reaching out to her nature itself. I totally agree.
That's the wisdom that I yes. think that there
is. Well, then one of your weapons then is, I remember you told me that you used to organize travel things.
I do.
So one of your weapons then is to actually take people to the forest in India.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there is a global wellness conference that meets once a year in different places around the world. I never been to one of them because they charge a lot of money. But so I couldn't afford, but they Singapore, Hong Kong, you know, some North Algeria, they've been meeting. I've been getting their materials the last 2 years, since we had Menla. And they say there's a it's more than a trillion dollar industry now globally, which are precisely these industrial era people who have disposable income, who live in cities, wanting to go to
yeah.
some nature place
yeah.
and do that. And so that's another weapon in the travel business in a way. There's kind of special kind of eco travel thing.
I mean, that's what I did.
That's the third one.
Yeah.
Well, that's but you're not doing that now because of your...
No, now we're busy.
One thing people should know is you are also a fantastic artist. I remember listening to your chanting. You, of course, you often travel with KD, where he's kind of the principal, but you also chant in that. But you also do your own two tours and chantings and concerts you do as well.
When I have CDs. When there's time.
And you are amazing. And I remember I met Nina, Durga Nina. I met her in Hawaii, is where I first realized that. And she was chanting in a church.
Yeah.
And Ram Dass was there in his wheelchair. And when I looked at her, she looked just like, I mean, I never met Anandamayi Ma, but I've seen pictures and I thought I was seeing Anandamayi. I remember I told you.
Thank goodness for you being there. I was so nervous.
Really? I mean, that was one of the first times you did?
Well, not if in a big room like that with Ram Dass. That was the first time.
But you were fantastic.
Well, thank you. And then I got off and then I looked out in the audience at one point and I thought, oh my gosh, not only is Ram Dass here, but so is Bob Thurman. How am I going to do this? And there you were.
And you were tremendous.
And you encouraged me a lot, and I'm so grateful for that.
That was really great.
Yeah.
So she's also a great artist, you know. But anyway, when you get your $1 billion, when we have bright money, then that'll be another, you can revive such a company, you know. And then, you know, in the yatras that I want to do in the coming years, now that I'm retired, you know, and I don't have to go on and teach undergraduates in the class half the year. Mm-hmm. Then I think we'll do some forest ones. Nina really wants to do that.
Well,
remember, we just almost tried to do it. Yeah. Actually, you know, that monastery thing that I just went to, if the other group I was working with had been more hip, and if I was able to work without them, which I'm going to do in the future, and not always going to be exclusive with them, we could have had a great group there, actually. But the one thing about the Tibetan monasteries that's terrible is this protected area permit routine that is done by the Interior Ministry in India. That's so awful. You can't, it's very hard to get it.
Sure.
And you submit for it 6 months ahead. People didn't get them in.
To stay there, you mean, right?
No, just to go and visit.
Or to just even
not
go.
Not just to stay, to visit.
To visit.
Uh-huh. Even to go inside and if someone goes into the protected area, 6,000 acre place that they have, this particular one I was at, which is Mundgod, near the town of Mundgod, near Hubli.
Yeah.
If they catch you going in there without it, they ban your visa from India forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which
yeah,
I think Modi will change because he wants tourism. But I have to get another meeting with Modi, and get him to go change that and stop that. You know, that was okay when they were just fragile beginning. Now they're big. They have big monasteries, and they're the strongest element in that region. In fact, and they're doing outreach and helping villages with their water problems.
Sure.
Around them, you know.
Well, that's the other thing. Any tourism project that's undertaken has to be done very mindfully because I've seen tourism go completely wrong in India as well.
Yes.
So we have to be very careful about that. So
that's
important.
So that's great. So are there any, you've given us some final charges about the Mother Earth and so forth. Actually, my Nina, her father was a nature person, a hunter, of course.
That's how they started.
He was a cavalry officer guy.
Yeah.
But he was he had talked to horses. He was famous as a horseman.
Oh, yeah.
But he used to take her out in the woods, and then he told her whenever she was upset or things were going wrong, she was disturbed, just go out, sit at the foot of a tree, and just be somewhere. It doesn't have to be some faraway place, but wherever it is. It could be in a park, and just become alert to what's going on around in nature, and it'll calm you down, and you'll feel better. And you'll
That's
feel
how it's been
happier,
for us. You know? We were talking about ashrams this morning. When I go back to Kenchi, and when I used to go and see Siddhi Ma there, you know, she had us wake up in the morning. Our sadhana started early in the morning at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, yeah. Well, please tell us more about Siddhi Ma in Rishikesh. Can you tell your second guru there, right? After Baba.
Well, Maharaji. I never met Maharaji myself.
Oh, I see.
So I met Maharaji through Krishnadas's chanting, actually.
I see.
So
me too.
Yeah. And I was so curious to understand the roots of where that of that wellspring, like where was he finding that love that was coming through his chanting.
Right.
And I was envious that he had had this guru.
Yeah.
And he said, you don't need a guru in the body. And I said, you know, that's very easy for you to say because you've had that already.
Right.
And I said, but I have to go back to wherever it is. And he told us the stories.
Yes.
And so finally, in the same way that Maharaji told Ram Dass not to tell anybody where he was.
Yes.
KD was not encouraging people to go to Kenchi. But after a while, he's like, all right. This is where it is.
All right.
And when you go,
yes,
you will meet Siddhima.
Yes.
She was with Maharaji for 40 years.
I see.
And the whole time that he was also there with Maharaji, yes, the Maas, Maharaji was very, he was saving the best, it seems, for later. The Maas were always kept in a very protected area. They were not outside with all the Westerners, but they were watching.
I see.
And they saw everything that was going on.
I see.
And if you talk to Krishnadas, he'll also tell you that he used to hear the chanting when? At night, when Maharaji went inside, the Maas would be up and they would all be sitting and chanting together.
Oh.
And they realized that he was sitting outside, so they would crack the window
so
that he could listen. And Siddhima knows, like she knows all these stories. They could see from behind the window screen what was going on out there.
I see.
So Ma then, after Maharaji left the body, was the keeper of the memories, the stories, mm-hmm, the bhav, the devotional nectar.
Mm-hmm.
And she made a place for all the devotees, if they chose to arrive.
I see.
To keep that space of Maharaji there. And Maharaji,
at Kenchi she did that? You mean Kenchi, she moved? I thought she moved.
She did. They also entrusted her. He also entrusted her with the care of the whatever temples were set up.
I see.
But mostly she was in Kenchi.
I see.
And then she built a temple for Maharaji in Rishikesh after he left the body.
I see. Okay.
So that was her temple that she
built. And is that still there now?
It is.
She left the body. So now
she left
who is taking care of that now?
The trust.
I see. But it's, I mean, there are
there are people who are in charge of it.
There are main disciples of her who's the main guru there?
There's no guru.
Do you go there? There's no guru there.
There's no guru in that, so to speak. There's not a formal lineage in it.
Oh, there is not.
There never was. I mean, Maharaji entrusted her with the care of the temples.
Yes.
His simple gesture, when he was ready to take samadhi,
yes,
he walked, he was leaving Kenchi, he turned around and said to Ma, because one of his practices was writing Ram Nam in a book.
Yes.
And he said, okay, now this is going to be your job. And he left the page.
I see.
Left the book with her, dropped his blanket, and walked out of the ashram.
I see.
So she has that blanket now that she carries with her. It's on the puja any time. Well, now, of
it's
course,
in Kenchi.
Yeah, but when she was in the body, I still think of her as there.
I know.
She always carried the blanket, always went first.
I see.
As Maharaji went first, and then she would follow. So now the blanket is, I believe, in Kenchi. I'm not even sure where it is anymore.
But there's no one teacher who's like kind of the really big, carrying the torch.
No.
And does that mean there's less activity there and less people coming?
Well, social media has made it such that's not the case, because it was revealed that Mark Zuckerberg went to Kenchi and Steve Jobs went to Kenchi back in the day.
Oh.
And so it's now all the Indians are going because it's cool. And then when Krishnadas goes there, like the Indians go. Now when I go there, people write me like, oh, when are you coming to India? We want to come and chant Hanuman Chalisa with you. So it kind of came from the west to the east, like with teachers like you, from the east to the west. And now it's going back to the east again.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, dear. I think we probably reached the time.
And
it's wonderful talking to you.
We must do
it again.
Okay, always.
And we're going to save these tigers and save the whole thing. Absolutely.
Yes.
There's Siddhima and Maharaji, yes.
Okay, thank you.
I want to add Dalai Lama, have them cuddling up there together.
Yes, sounds good.
And have a look at this part of there. I want to have that.
Thank you.
So that's it. That's the podcast. See you all later, next time.
Thanks so much for listening. Do join the conversation by leaving your comments on this page and also sharing this podcast. We connect most deeply with our own hearts when we remember we are a part of nature and made of it. With that, we revere and conserve the wisdom that is alive in Mother Nature, as lakes, rivers, oceans, mountains, deserts, forests, the skies, the soil, all home and sanctuary to all beings, including us. To find out more about chant recordings and live events, please visit ninaraochant.com. To find out more about my wilderness conservation efforts for over 20 years, please visit savingwildtigers.org. Thank you again. Govinda.